This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 112, recorded December 17th, 2010. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and it's time for TWIV, This Week in Virology. Joining me today from Western Massachusetts is Alan Dove.
Good to be here.
How are you?
Doing okay. Staying relatively warm.
Freezing out there, isn't it?
Oh, well below freezing.
Let's see what the temperature is in North Central Florida, where we would find Rich Condit.
76 degrees.
Bah!
You know, Rich, you could have given me warm weather last week.
Sorry, I'm good, but I'm not that good.
I thought you could handle it. And we went south Myers it was cold.
It has been very cold up until this very day, up until today, and now it's come back. It's nice again.
Even down at Fort Myers, they blamed me for bringing the cold weather.
Uh-huh. That's right. We got to blame somebody.
Well, this week, it has been routinely negative 6 centigrade here, and probably colder up by Allen.
No, thanks.
I understand you had your fill of cold weather.
Yeah.
But did you have your fill of virology?
No. I'm still cooking.
All right. Well, today we have some recipes. We have two cool stories. So let's do it. Dixon is not here, of course. Dixon's off to Mexico until the 10th of January.
Continuing his globetrotting.
He's going fishing.
Oh, this is fit for a fishing expedition. Okay.
Yeah, some remote place on the eastern coast where you fish. And as he said, he's just going to fish and drink and do other things.
Sounds great.
I don't know. I'd rather podcast about viruses.
Yes, of course.
Right.
We have two stories. And the first one, I think someone sent to you, Rich. Would that have been Grant?
No, actually, I...
You picked it up?
Yeah, I actually found this myself.
As opposed to your colleagues or your wife, right?
That's right. That's right.
Well, this is a really cool story. The title of the paper is Poxvirus Interleukin-4 Expression Overcomes Inherent Resistance and Vaccine-Induced Immunity, Pathogenesis, Prophylaxis, and Antiviral Therapy. And this is by Chen, Ballone, Schreuer, Owens, Fredrickson, Parker, and Buller. Right. But the real paper is one that came out in 2001.
Well, the paper that inspired this one. This one's real.
I shouldn't say the real paper. What I mean is the original observation on which this is based, which shook the world. Well, maybe not the world, but was pretty controversial. Expression of mouse interleukin-4 by a recombinant extramyeliovirus suppresses cytolytic lymphocyte responses and overcomes genetic resistance to mousepox. And that's by Jackson, Ramsey, Christensen, Beaton, Hall, and Ramshaw. And I guess we should do that one first, right? Right, Rich?
Sure. Actually, I didn't really have that as queued up as the other one.
Well, you
but
can
the
do
basic,
it.
The ba- I can do it off the cuff. Sure. I can tell you what the basic observation is. Actually, I'd like to give a little background, because the background, as is often the case, is as interesting as anything else. First, let's do a little immunology 101, because I actually have to review this for myself every time I think about this stuff. So when we encounter a pathogen, it triggers an immune response. There's two phases to that. The first is what we call the innate response, which is nonspecific. That is, your body knows you're infected with something, but it doesn't know what it is. And it summons all sorts of nonspecific cells that eat this thing or kill it, natural killer cells and a bunch of others. And there are a bunch of signals that are sent out during that process in the form of what we call cytokines. These are small peptides or proteins that are made by the immune cells that have the effect of shaping the immune response, the innate response and the subsequent response. Part of what happens is that triggers the adaptive response, which takes a little longer. The adaptive response is what we are familiar with as having actually two arms, ultimately. One is the cellular response. Those are killer T cells that specifically recognize cells that are infected with a pathogen and destroy those cells. And the other arm are B cells. Those are cells that make antibody that can bind to a pathogen that's free and ultimately lead to its destruction and processing. The shaping of that part of the response is also controlled by cytokines. These are called, the cytokines that work in the immune system are called interleukins. And those two arms of the, the adaptive response obviously is specific for the pathogen and ultimately involves memory of the pathogen so that when you encounter it next time, the response is quicker and more robust. That's what gives you immunity. So in the current parlance, the antibody arm of the response is called the Th1 response. There are helper cells that stimulate the ultimately the B cells to make antibodies. Those T helper cells. That's the Th2 part of the response. And then there's the Th1, T helper ones shape the cellular response. And the cytokines can influence which of these parts develop. There are specific cytokines for development of each part. We're going to talk about a cytokine called IL-4, which promotes the Th2 response, that is, promotes the elaboration of antibody, ultimately. This story actually goes all the way back to a story we've talked about many times before, and that is biological control of pests in Australia. Originally, this had to do with trying to control the rabbits, where they used a myxoma virus, which doesn't do anything to South American rabbits. But if you stick it into European rabbits, which had overrun Australia, it kills them quickly and very dead, all dead. But ultimately, the rabbits gained resistance to the virus. The virus became attenuated, so that was only a temporary solution. Apparently, they also have a rodent control problem in Australia. And as part of a program to try and use biological measures to control both the rabbits and the mice, people were trying to modify pox viruses. Myxoma is a pox virus. Modify pox viruses, either rabbit pox viruses, which is myxoma, or mouse pox viruses, which is Ectromelia, to create infertility in the animals they infected. And the idea here was that you would clone into the virus an egg protein that would be expressed during the virus infection. And hopefully the animal, because there was a superabundance of this protein, would make antibody to the egg protein so that ultimately it would those antibodies would destroy the eggs and make the animals sterile. They had some limited success with this, but it wasn't quite working well enough. And so they being this Ramshaw group at the Animal Pest Control Cooperative Research Center, in the CSIRO in Australia, started playing around with trying to reshape the immune response in the animals that were infected with the virus to see if they could get a more robust elaboration of antibody to assist in this sterilization technique. So one of the ways they did that was to take one of these cytokines, IL-4, and clone it into mouse pox, and then along with the egg protein, and then infect mice with this recombinant that had the egg protein and the IL-4 in it, thinking that since IL-4 ordinarily promotes the Th2 or antibody response in the immune system, they could pump up the amount of antibody and get a better sterilization with this. And much to their surprise, what happened was that rather than what they predicted, they wound up with a virus that was extra lethal and also would cause lethality in animals that had actually been immunized against pox viruses. So in mice, there are varying susceptibilities to mouse pox depending on the mouse strain. There are resistant strains and there are sensitive strains. And what they found was that this virus that expressed IL-4 would actually kill a strain that was normally resistant to mouse pox.
Yeah.
And they also found that if they even immunized those mice with vaccinia so that they were resistant completely to normal, I mean, normal wild-type virus will actually infect these animals and cause a little bit of disease. It just doesn't kill them. If they immunized them to the point where they would be resistant to wild-type virus and then infected them with this IL-4-expressing virus, the IL-4-expressing virus would kill those mice too.
Hmm.
So that, this was in 2001.
Right.
It was actually, the research was done in the 90s, and I am told that they discussed for a long time whether they actually ought to publish this.
Right.
Because here they've created a virus that is more virulent than what they started with. A pox virus, no less.
A pox virus that gets around immunity that's either genetic or vaccine derived.
Right. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
So that, this is even before we'd started thinking about bioterrorism.
Paper was published in February of 2001.
Right.
Well, I think this was a big motivator to looking at bioterror issues, aside from 9/11 and the anthrax. But this was a motivator because I know at ASM, where this was published in Journal of Virology, there's a lot of talk about whether they should publish papers like this and whether they should be withheld. So this was a precipitator.
Right.
But the other issue here was that the authors, and they were interviewed extensively, as you might guess, this hit the press big time. They, and that's before blogs really hit the scene, really.
Right.
They said they were surprised at this result.
Right.
And there was an accompanying paper in the journal, Journal of Virology, entitled Creation of Killer Pox Virus Could Have Been Predicted. And let's see, what was the year and month of that? Was it in the same issue or a separate one? It was September 01.
September, of course.
And when was the paper published?
February.
Okay, so.
But September, this is then, that is, I wonder if it's after September 11, right?
Well, yeah, it was published in September, so it was probably submitted well before that.
Okay,
right.
So, and the thing is, it's from the original paper was from Australia, and so is this one. This is from Mühlbacher and Lobigs.
Right.
And they basically said you could have predicted all this. And they think that the authors of the other paper, just to get in a little aside here, they think the authors of the other paper were being disingenuous in saying they were surprised. Who knows? Do you remember this controversy at all, guys?
I remember being, freaked out when I first heard about this. It's a little spooky. I don't remember a lot of controversy at the time over whether it should have been published or all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think it's I choose to believe that they were not actually being disingenuous. I mean, I'm not an immunologist, but heck, I wouldn't have predicted this. You don't know what to predict.
Yeah, as I recall, and I was a science journalist at the time. I mean, it was not huge. Gosh, the sky is falling type of news. But of course, this is pre 9/11. It was before the multi-billion-dollar mushrooming of the biodefense industry. So this was a finding that got a lot of people. I think it certainly got my attention at the time. I remember this and saying, "Wow, that's a little scary." But as I thought about it, I thought, well, I think it was right to publish it because I don't think that you gain anything by trying to hide something like this.
I agree.
And I think that there's also probably a lot less potential to this than some people would believe.
Hmm. And some of that comes out in the second paper.
So there's an interesting sentence from this Creation of Killer Pox Virus Could Have Been Predicted, worth reading. They say that this story received wide coverage in the scientific and popular press. The reason for the heightened public interest was the implication that a means had inadvertently been discovered to allow the creation of killer viruses with potential biological warfare application. According to some of the authors of the study, this came as a complete surprise and was totally unexpected. However, a closer reading of the literature on consequences of infection with recombinant pox viruses encoding IL-4, some performed by members of the above study, suggests otherwise. So that's why. And there was a lot of controversy. And I remember at the time thinking this virus will never spread in the wild because you stick a gene into it and it's going to mess something up.
Right.
That's really my feeling with all of this stuff. You know, nature evolves viruses that are perfect at spreading and you mess it up by putting right. in a gene.
And in fact, that conclusion of yours is borne out in the subsequent studies. Because they do look at transmission in this more recent paper.
Right.
Now, so I guess the fear was that someone would do this with smallpox, right?
Right.
And sure. Create a smallpox that had immune modulators in it and could be lethal even in people who'd been vaccinated.
Would that be easy to do, Rich?
Sure. Yeah. Cloning, expressing genes in a, well, if you're going to do it in smallpox, first, you got to get smallpox. Then I suppose if you're into bioterror, what you're going to do is vaccinate everybody in your laboratory and not worry about biosafety precautions in your laboratory. You're just going to do it over in a corner on the sly and hope it doesn't get out prematurely. Okay, but I mean, that's all, you know, spy novel stuff.
Except that if you're working on a virus to bypass the vaccine, vaccinating your staff isn't going to do you much good.
True enough. At any rate, technically, making the recombinant virus
is easy.
If
you did this with vaccinia, it would make it more lethal, right?
Theoretically, yeah.
Because vaccinia could be pretty nasty, right?
Yeah. So theoretically, it would make it nastier. But, you know, once again, I don't know enough immunology. A lot of this depends probably on the normal pathogenesis of the virus. In the case of mousepox, you're getting a systemic infection that starts in the site of inoculation, which is the foot pad, replicates in regional lymph nodes, establishes a viremia, infects the liver and the spleen, replicates there, secondary viremia, ultimately makes it to the skin. Okay, and when the case of vaccinia, you get just a local lesion. You only in immunocompromised individuals do you get spread. And my guess is that that background biology is going to impact on how altering the immune response is going to affect the outcome of the infection. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to predict what it would do with vaccinia. Certainly based on this, you would, one reasonable prediction is that it would make it more virulent, but I don't know.
Yeah. And of course, I think it wouldn't spread among people anyway, so it would be kind of right. moot. So what was the reason for doing this other study, the one that you picked up?
Well, I think there's several motivations. First of all, as we've said many times before, science is self-correcting. It's important that stuff be reproduced, stuff that's important like this, okay? So it was important to do it from scratch in another laboratory and make sure that the original claims were all verifiable, and I'm glad they did that. They also point out some minor shortcomings of the original studies. That they used an ectromelia that had they'd cloned into a gene that that already attenuates the virus, the thymidine kinase gene. They'd only looked at one construct. They didn't really know what the effect of expression of different amounts of IL-4 might be. And the studies were fairly limited in terms of the biology. There were things that they didn't look at, like transmission, et cetera. So they wanted to confirm and extend those studies and make sure they had the whole thing under control.
And they also, another thing that they checked was that the virus was actually killing the mice and not the IL-4 that they inserted.
Yes. Yes. True. Good.
Would you clarify the IL-4, the gene that they put in the virus, was that murine IL-4?
Now, there's a good question.
I think in this paper it is, but let me look in the other one.
End of the introduction, they say TK positive recombinant ECTV expressing mouse IL-4.
There you go. It's mouse. Okay.
Good.
So everybody used mouse IL-4.
Yeah, if you put human in, that would be a problem because you're going to get an antibody response. Right.
Actually, part of the background that I hadn't been aware of that's really interesting is apparently this kind of stuff has been done with a bunch of different viruses. In the introduction,
yes.
they say
yes.
expression of IL-4 by retroviruses, adenoviruses, vesicular stomatitis, and herpes had resulted in little effect on viral pathogenesis, whereas IL-4 expression by influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, and vaccinia virus delayed viral clearance or enhanced pathogenesis in mice. So right there, I would say that based on that sort of history, and some of this stuff is back from the 90s, you wouldn't necessarily know what to predict would happen, at least in the initial vaccine experiment.
Lobigs thinks that you could, but we'll let people judge for themselves. We'll put a link. I think on a simple level, this would mean that for retroviruses, adeno, and VSV and herpes, that the antibody response is probably most important for pathogenesis. And all you're doing with IL-4 is skewing it towards antibody responses, so that's going to only make things better.
Right.
Yeah, I hadn't been aware of that either. That's very interesting.
So what they did here is they basically repeated the experiments in what they feel is a cleaner fashion. What is actually a cleaner fashion? They put the IL-4 into a non-essential region of the virus so that they weren't doing anything to the normal biology of the virus. And they actually made several different constructs that expressed different levels of IL-4 and expressed them either early during infection or late during infection or throughout infection. And they actually cloned in point mutants of IL-4 as controls to make sure that they didn't get the same effects with those. And then they looked at expression and pathogenesis in the mice, and they saw expression that was appropriate to the strength of the promoter that they used. And basically, they reproduced the original results. They found that if they infected a resistant mice with the IL-4 recombinant, it killed them with very low doses of virus. Actually, I like this. In some cases, it's the LD50 is, here's one that's 2.8 times 10 to the minus 2.
Whoa. So
less than one particle per one infectious unit per mouse. And they say, how can that be? Well, what it tells you is that the plaque assays are not as good a measure
not as sensitive,
of infectivity as the assays in the mouse. So basically, one particle will kill these animals. And they found appropriately elevated levels of virus in the liver and the spleen relative to wild type. They found massive necrosis in those tissues with very little infiltration of inflammatory cells. So that's evidence that what's happening here is the virus is, you're not getting an appropriate cytotoxic killer cell response in the affected organs like liver and spleen, and the virus is replicating out of control and killing these animals. They also did, this to me is one of the most interesting experiments, they did a transmission experiment where they infected mice and serially stuck them into cages with uninfected mice and then looked at the uninfected mice to see if they became infected. And basically, the wild-type ectromelia virus was like 100% transmissible to uninfected animals, very transmissible. And the IL-4-containing mouse was not transmissible hardly at all. I think one other mouse got infected or something like that. So even though it's very lethal, it doesn't transmit very well. And ultimately, they say that they think that's because this virus doesn't replicate in the ultimate target organ, the skin, very well. And it's transmitted mostly from shedding from the skin. And since it's not replicating in the skin well, it's not transmitted well.
Which could be, I guess, because the initial viremia is hitting the organs and killing the mouse before it
could be. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The time to death is it's very quick. And also they do two kinds of vaccination experiments, and I'm not sure. I think this goes beyond what was done in the original paper. They vaccinate either with Dryvax, which is vaccinia virus. That's the smallpox vaccine. Or they vaccinate, they infect resistant mice with wild-type virus. Those mice recover, mm-hmm. so they're effectively vaccinated, and then they infect them with the IL-4-containing virus. What they find is if they vaccinate with vaccinia virus, that those mice become resistant to a wild-type infection. But if they vaccinate, but they're still sensitive to the infection by the IL-4 virus. So the IL-4 expressing virus is breaking through that immunity. Yeah, however,
should be in there. It's uniformly lethal, they say, in right. vaccinated mice.
Right. However, if they take mice that have effectively been vaccinated with mousepox, that IL-4 containing virus is no longer uniformly lethal in those animals. So vaccinia and ectromelia are, as they say, over 95% identical in terms of their gene products. But there's enough differences so that if you're vaccinated with the real thing, you are protected better against the infection with the IL-4 containing virus than you are if you were vaccinated with vaccinia virus.
So why is it in the original paper that they did immunize with ectromelia, right?
They did.
And those mice were all killed by the IL-4 producing virus.
So in the original paper, was that with ectromelia?
It says reinfection of mice immunized against ectromelia. I assume that's what it was.
Immunized against extra, but not what were they immunized with?
Okay.
Okay, they were immunized with the attenuated virus ECTV602. So it's ectromelia.
So they were immunized with ectromelia.
Yeah.
I don't recall whether they say anything in this new paper about the difference between those two studies. I'd have to look.
So the numbers are percent mortality if they infect with the homologous virus, just the same virus as they were immunized against, there's 0% mortality and 60% mortality with the IL-4 expressing virus. So not 100%, but
so I guess it depends on how you evaluate it. It's still, you could say it still does break through the immunity, and we'd have to compare the numbers critically to see how different that is from what was published before.
I mean, they say the immunizing with ectromelia provided protection against the IL-4 producing virus, but it didn't eliminate death at all. It didn't completely prevent lethality.
Right. So here they say treatments using this is in the discussion of the new papers. Treatments using Dryvax were evaluated. Prime boost immunizations failed to protect even when challenges were initiated during a period of high levels of specific T cells. Prior infection with wild-type ectromelia completely protected mice from lethal IL-4 recombinant infections. This was also observed by Jackson et al., where an attenuated recombinant virus was able to protect 40% of immunized mice from challenge. So they're saying
similar results.
They're saying that it's actually similar.
Okay. But that's not the kind of protection you'd want in people.
No.
Probably worth pointing out.
Right.
On the other hand, if the virus doesn't transmit, then you're not too worried about that.
Right. They say, in spite of replicating the higher titers in examined tissues, the IL-4 infected mice were less efficient in transmission to contact, suggesting an effect of IL-4 on virus replication in the skin, the primary source of transmissible virus. And then, obviously, they've got the smallpox infections experiments ideas on their mind. They say, based on severe immunosuppression induced by the IL-4 recombinant infections and reduced transmissibility, we speculate that a variola, that is smallpox, expressing IL-4 may cause a disease similar to or more severe than hemorrhagic smallpox. That's a speculation, put it that way. Hemorrhagic smallpox is thought to occur in subjects in varying degrees of immunodeficiency. Compared with ordinary smallpox, presents with a shorter time of death, more severe disease manifestations that may result in earlier hospitalization and or isolation, which could result in less efficient person-to-person transmission of variola. So that's very speculative, but they're saying what you're saying, Vincent, and that is they figure that if you made a smallpox virus with this, it might be nastier in individuals, but would perhaps not be as readily transmissible. Now, there's one other thing they do that's important, and that is they're actually, since the Ramshaw lab paper originally came out, there have been researched and developed a couple of pox antiviral drugs. One is sidofovir, which is a nucleoside analog and inhibits viral DNA replication, and the other is a compound called ST246 that inhibits the final stages of assembly and actually spread of the virus. And they find that treatment of the IL-4 the IL-4 recombinant infected mice cannot be cured with either of these drugs alone, but a combination of the two drugs together can stop the infection. So that's an important observation as well. That suggests that if somebody were crazy enough to come up with something like this, that in fact combination drug therapy might be effective in limiting it.
I found it interesting that the monotherapy did not protect.
Mm-hmm.
And they say in the discussion, they conclude, which is really the take-home lesson here, a functioning immune system is necessary for successful antiviral treatment of robust pox virus infection.
Right.
So the antiviral itself isn't enough. Your immune system has to help out.
Right.
And I wonder in how many other viral infections that's the case.
Probably quite a few.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I think this is, I think of, there are antibiotics, right, that are bactericidal and others that are bacteriostatic, right? So there are some antibiotics that don't actually kill the bacteria, but just stop it from replicating.
Right.
And then your immune system takes over and clears the system and clears the pathogen. And my guess is that there are a lot of antivirals that are the same way. A typical thing that's done in these, as one of the things in studying these antivirals, is to infect animals, treat them with a drug, and then when the animals recover, ask if they are immune to reinfection. And that is, to some extent, a measure of how much replication of the virus there was initially.
Mm,
so it's not too much of a surprise that immunity is part of the ultimate clearing mechanism with these drugs.
Right.
Well, the bottom line here is that if anyone was worried about this, they shouldn't be, because it doesn't transmit very effectively.
Which is exactly what you might predict if you're a virologist.
Yeah, right. I like the last sentence of the paper made me crazy. It's the following. And finally, the reduced transmissibility of Ectromelia IL-4 for mice suggests that pox viruses expressing IL-4, while lethal for those infected, may or may not initiate an epidemic. Now, I don't understand, Alan, tell me, if you say suggest, why do you have to say may or may not? I would say they suggest that it may not initiate an epidemic, right?
Right. Yeah, it's
waffling.
They're trying to couch it as thoroughly as possible.
I mean, if it doesn't spread from, well, this is a mouse virus, so it's not going to do anything in people anyway, but
right.
It doesn't spread in mice, I would guess that it. Not likely that the human virus would spread in humans. Of course, we don't know unless you do it. We can't do that experiment. But I think they should have been a little more forceful there. I don't know. Maybe the journal made them do that. Hey, this is a great paper. I like it.
Part of their conclusions also is that The recombinants are useful tools for evaluating the potency of candidate antivirals, since they induce a profound immunosuppression in all tested mouse strains. The studies indicate that it should be possible to develop effective countermeasures against pox viruses expressing IL-4 or other molecules. So, you know, the question arises again, should these experiments have been done? Should they have been published? That's the kind of stuff that's going to come up. And I think this is a good example of the answer to that is, I think, is a resounding yes. Okay? The follow-up on the, I mean, you could have said after the initial observation and publication that nobody ought to work on this stuff anymore. Okay? And no matter if they do, it shouldn't be published because we don't want to give the terrorists the tools that they need to make these nasty creatures. And I think this paper argues exactly against that because we learn more about this. We learn that it probably isn't as scary as it might have seemed to start with. And that stuff definitely needs to be published.
Right.
And we also learn that antiviral drugs might be effective against such a thing. We learn which drugs might be effective and how to find more, which is, you know, if you are scared of this, then that's incredibly useful information that never would have come out if the first paper hadn't been done or hadn't been published.
Right.
It's worth pointing out the scenario that people might be worried about. So smallpox, in order to use it as a weapon, you would probably infect someone and have that person walk into a major city, and then just by being there, it would spread because it's transmissible.
Right. Right?
In 1947 in New York, this is a time before eradication, we had a vaccine, but there was still smallpox around the world. A guy, an American, came to New York from Mexico City. He got sick. He went to a hospital. He died. And then a couple of people who were in the hospital, a baby and a man, got smallpox a couple days later. And then a few other people ended up getting smallpox. So from this one person, the virus spread to others. And if I think they immunized millions of people and stopped the spread, but that's the scenario. You know, if you have a naive population as we do now, no immunity, the virus could presumably spread more. So in this case, this virus, you know, would be put into someone. That person would walk into New York, and it wouldn't spread because it can't, as we saw in this paper.
Not only that, but he'd be too sick to walk.
You got to time it right, right. That's a good point. With smallpox, you can walk for a while after being infected, right? Yeah, maybe a day after this one, you wouldn't. So it's not a great terror weapon. In fact, I'm not a big fan of bioterrorism using viruses because I just don't think it works. We're not smart enough to design a virus that would really work.
Well, and the whole biodefense thing, I agree that there should be some work on this, and yes, there is a possibility, and people have tried to use biological weapons in the past, but if you look at the track record of these, what really stands out is how dismally ineffective most biological weapons have been. Even the former Soviet Union had an extremely well-funded and massive research program, and they did some very sophisticated science trying to develop you know, more lethal pathogens to use as biological weapons. And the results were, you know, kind of meh as a weapons system. And when you consider what people can do with some box cutters and basic flight training, there's not really a good reason for a terrorist organization to go to all this trouble.
I don't know. Maybe that a virus like smallpox is a good weapon because you don't have to change it. It's quite lethal, and we're not immunizing any longer.
If you can get it and if you can distribute it, if you can distribute it faster than the vaccine stockpiles would get out. But those are a lot of big ifs.
Well, I guess that all the preparedness that we've been doing would help in that scenario, right?
Yes, so, and I think there's a good argument for keeping stockpiles of vaccines around and for, you know, kind of pondering what might happen and being prepared. But I don't think we need to go all overboard with it.
The whole bioterrorism thing has, with respect to pox viruses, had, as you've already suggested, a couple of major consequences. There's been a lot of research into vaccines and drugs, and we're now going to have stockpiled a vaccine that is much safer than anything that was used before, and we're going to have two effective antiviral drugs. So that if there is ever a problem with smallpox or a related pox virus, which is not an impossibility, even outside of biodefense, we're going to be prepared for that. And I think right. that's a good thing. The whole biodefense thing has also stimulated a lot of research on nasty pathogens that probably wouldn't have gotten much play otherwise. And also has morphed into this a lot of research on emerging virus infections. So it's not all a bad thing, but I do think it's been sort of overplayed, overstated. But I think people are catching on to that. The biodefense bubble is burst.
Yeah, I think it's legitimate. It has certainly resulted in funding for a lot of good science, and for people who work on that. I'm not insulting the science that they're doing, but I disagree with folks getting worked up into a lather about it.
I'm with you on that. Yep.
So in parting, is it correct that this infection of mice with ectromelia, that's what Frank Fenner worked on?
Yes, I was going to mention. Yeah, so we eulogized Frank two episodes ago. He was responsible for the original experiments introducing myxoma into Australia as a biological weapon against the rabbits, and he was the guy who did the classic virus pathogenesis experiments by studying the pathogenesis of mouse pox in mice. So this is all derived from Frank's initial work in the 50s yep. and 60s. Yep, it's great. Now, I suppose the other thing we should mention here, we've been talking about smallpox, and as Alan points out, as a bioterror weapon, one of the issues with smallpox is actually getting your hands on smallpox. And I suppose one of the things about this research is that it suggests that you might be able to take a virus like vaccinia, which you mentioned, Vincent, or something else like cowpox, which is readily available but not very pathogenic in humans, and by tweaking the immune response by cloning interleukins of one sort or another into it, make it more virulent in humans. But that's, once again, I agree with you, that's pretty speculative. I think that Mother Nature has already done about as best as can be done with smallpox, and mm-hmm. it's going to be hard for us to do much better than that.
Good paper, good discussion. And let's move on to paper number two, a different virus, influenza virus. And this is actually very interesting also, and it addresses, someone asked us not too long ago in an email whether there were any other infections like dengue where the immune response made for a worse disease. And we had said, we answered by saying we didn't know of any, and now here is an example. That's the way science works. The name of the paper is Severe Pandemic 2009. H1N1 influenza disease due to pathogenic immune complexes. This is from a large group from Vanderbilt in Tennessee and Buenos Aires. A lot of authors on this paper. And the basic problem being addressed here is last year when the pandemic H1N1 strain emerged, older people over 65 were relatively spared. And we know now that's because they had cross-reactive antibodies from older experiences with strains related to the H1N1. Young children got sick. That's because they didn't have antibodies. But the people in between, 18 to 65, had pretty severe disease. And as an example, there's a very nice table at CDC, which gives you the summary of last year's pandemic in the U.S., So if we look at deaths, 0 to 17 years of age, there are 1,280 deaths. 65 years and older, 1,600 deaths. But 18 to 64 years, 9,570 deaths. So that's an odd distribution. Usually in seasonal influenza, the severe deaths are in the older people. Okay, so why is that? That's what this paper is trying to figure out. So they speculate at the onset, one reason for the severe illness is that maybe they have antibodies as a result of all the previous infections with flu that they have that recognize the virus but don't neutralize it, and you get immune complex disease. So that would be a similar situation as dengue. You get a second infection with dengue. You get antibodies that bind the virus but don't neutralize, and they lead to immune-mediated disease. Right?
Yeah, similar in that the pre-existing non-neutralizing antibodies are the culprit,
right,
but mechanistically out the other end, somewhat different.
Yes.
In this case, we're talking about immune complex disease. In the case of dengue, you're talking about enhanced infection of the virus in macrophages,
exactly,
because
right,
of their, because it's coated, yeah, with non-neutralizing antibodies. And I don't fully understand the immune complex disease. I'm hoping that you can explain that to me. It's deposition of immune complexes in the tissues, right? And
right,
messing the tissues up that way.
Right. So here it's an immune complex deposition, an activation of the complement system.
Right.
So complement is part of the immune system, a series of proteins that react to infections and try and eliminate them. So usually it's supposed to be a protective system, the complement system. So for example, if you have an envelope virus and you make antibodies against it, complement proteins will react with the antibody virus complex and lyse the virus membrane. So that's one way that complement can work. It can also lead to the production of cytokines, which leads to inflammation. It can stimulate phagocytosis of pathogens, so forth. So normally it has good consequences, but you can imagine that it can be bad. For example, it has the complement system has the ability to lyse membranes. So if that isn't properly directed, it can damage your tissues.
So the idea here is you have these low avidity antibodies. They bind the virus, but they don't neutralize it. So the virus can go on and infect cells. But what you're left with is these immune complexes that it formed that
right,
go gumming up, say, the lungs, and the complement ends up targeting the lungs and you get inflammation.
Yeah. So the immune complexes are there and the complement system sees them and goes, oh, we need to get going here. And they start lysing and they're messing up the tissues. Exactly.
Still central to those immune complexes are the virus, right? The antibody is complexing with the virus but not neutralizing it. And that's what nucleates these immune complexes. And I would imagine
right,
the virus also stimulates, does it stimulate production of the antibodies from the pre-existing immunity? It's stimulating
sure,
a memory response,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, sure.
So you're getting a fairly high concentration of these antibodies to another virus, okay, and nucleating these immune complexes, okay.
Exactly. So you have to have virus present so the complement gets activated. And since the virus isn't neutralized, it can keep replicating. And yes, then you have a memory response, which amplifies the amount of antibodies. So you have this pathogenic situation. So that's, in fact, what happens. But that was their initial hypothesis. And so to get evidence in support of it, they got samples from people with serious disease last year. They had some aspirates, some washes from the lungs. They had some of the individuals had died, so they had sections, pathological sections from their lungs. And then they studied these. So they looked at lung sections and said, yeah, these people have really severe influenza in their lungs. They have a variety of infiltrations of various immune cells. They have a lot of lymphocytes in their lungs, which is indicative of infection. They could also find the viral RNA in the lung cells as well. Now, the key here is that they actually looked at cytokine levels in these aspirates and in the lung tissues. Some people feel that the so-called cytokine storms are responsible for severe influenza, but they found no evidence that there were higher levels of cytokines in the respiratory tract of these individuals. But what they did find that there was abundant antibody in the respiratory tract that is specific for the H1N1 virus, but it was low avidity, as Alan said, and they had an assay for measuring avidity and they compared, they had some samples from people with infections with seasonal strains, and they could show that there the antibodies are much higher avidity. But in these individuals with severe disease, there are plenty of antibodies present. They recognize the H1N1 strain, but they don't bind very strongly. And so they don't, and then in fact, they show that they don't neutralize viral infectivity.
So these antibodies probably came from some previous flu year.
Right, or multiple flu years.
Or multiple previous flu years. And so these people have some kind of sort of antibodies against 2009 H1N1, but they're not really against that virus the way the antibodies in people over 65 were against more appropriate antigens.
Right. So from 1977 to up until last year, there were a variety of H1N1s circulating. So these people were probably infected multiple times over the years and built up a repertoire. But then when the new H1N1 emerged last year, it didn't really get neutralized by any of those antibodies. They bound the virus, but they did not block its infectivity. And so they could detect these antibodies in the lungs of these individuals. And then, in fact, they could also detect one of the complement proteins in the lungs. I believe it's C4A. Let's see. Let's get that. Immune complex is
C4D.
C4D, yes. We stained lung sections for complement cleavage product C4D. We detected extensive C4D deposition. So that's the consequence of these virus antibody complexes. They're not neutralizing the virus, so you get a lot of virus produced. Antibodies are made by the memory response, and because of their presence, they activate complement, and you get these C4D products, which are part of the whole cascade of complement activation. And that's bad, and that's probably partly why they got such severe lung disease.
Okay. So theoretically, it seems to me, you could have this problem as a result of a vaccination.
In theory, yes, but fortunately, the memory is not terribly long with these inactivated flu vaccines.
Okay.
They don't induce good memory. This is probably a consequence of natural infections. Although, okay. You have to prove it, I agree, but it's probably not the case. It's probably
from infections. And I also wonder if you have vaccinations against enough serotypes. So in the dengue situation, it's two serotypes that's really bad news. Okay, you get infected with one, you have a memory from that. That infection is not as bad as hemorrhagic dengue. You get infected with a second serotype, and that's when you get hemorrhagic dengue. If you survive that and get infected with a third or a fourth, apparently you're in pretty good shape. So if you have immunity to two, even though neither of those alone would be sufficient to adequately handle a third serotype, the two combined apparently are good enough.
Right.
So I wonder what the situation with flu is. If you get vaccinated religiously every year, you may have enough immunity so that no matter what comes along, you'll be well. No, that's not true because the.
Well, if you get vaccinated every year and you prevent a natural infection, which makes the long-lived memory, then you're probably okay.
Right.
But really the thing you need to do is when a pandemic strain emerges, you have to get immunized against that.
Right.
And then you're not going to get this disease because you will have antibodies that neutralize the virus.
Right.
Now, tangential question. If given that immunity to two different dengue viruses gives you protection against hemorrhagic dengue, why can't we just immunize with two different dengue virus vaccines?
Well, that all is being explored, I believe.
Yeah,
okay?
I think that's the plan.
I think they're experimenting with a variety of different vaccines. I think some of the ones that are in trials have all four serotypes, but I think hypothetically you could do it with fewer.
Right.
Yeah, right. And of course there are the logistical problems of testing dengue vaccines as well, because you run the risk that you may increase somebody's risk of hemorrhagic dengue.
Right. Right. So they also looked in old frozen specimens from people who died in 1957 from H2N2 pandemic flu.
Can you believe they've got these things?
Yeah. It's amazing. Great. I think, I don't know where they came from, but maybe South America. You know, the Army keeps extensive samples, and that's why they were able to recover the 1918 influenza virus from a lot of these old Army specimens. But yeah, this is great that they have them. It's an argument for keeping stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So they stained for C4D, and they found it in those lungs as well, suggesting that maybe that those cases of severe influenza were also a consequence of immune complex formation. So I think this is great. I mean, well, it's not great for the people who died, but for science it's great because it's another example of a immune complex disease, and we were looking for one besides dengue, and here it is. So the moral is to get immunized. Now, sadly, last year, the vaccine against the virus, H1N1, swine origin H1N1, was a bit late. The peak of disease had already passed by the time there was good distribution of the vaccine. But in the future, hopefully, we'll have universal vaccines, and so this won't be an issue.
Actually, that's very interesting. The universal vaccines are going to have to be good.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Because if they aren't good enough, they could wind up doing more harm than good.
That's right. Absolutely.
They have And we've seen that before with stuff like the the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine.
Yep.
That actually exacerbated disease. That's mechanism's right. Not clear, but it could be something like the dengue situation. It could be something like this.
Yeah. That's a good point. I think when that universal vaccine is tested, this paper will loom large because yes. They will have to make very sure that it will neutralize every strain because, right. You know, when a new pandemic emerges, the idea is that that would be protective, that vaccine would be protective against it.
Right.
All right. There you have it. Immune complex disease. Most of the time, the immune response is good, but not always. Immunopathology. Let's do a few emails. One is from Jenny. I love your show very much, and this is not my first comment. I load firewood and paint as I listen to you guys. Thanks so much for the inspiration over what is becoming years. I'm not an audio learner, though my mind is quite stimulated by what I hear. I've purchased Dick's book, which I love. Okay, two parts. Reader pick and question. First, I have a reader pick for you. I'm an RN with an interest in science. I've been trying to teach myself about the immune system. I've gone through some books that were too complicated, Reut's, and too simple, and keep shopping for one that had it all. I seem to have found it and want to recommend it to you and your listeners. The Immune System by Peter Parnum or Parham?
Parnum.
It's Parnum. Put out by Garland Science. He's on the faculty at Stanford University, where he is professor in the departments of structural biology, microbiology, and immunology. This is an excellent book, good structure, knowledge building moves logically and progressively. He doesn't get stuck with pet ideas, nice pictures for visual folks like me, and at the end of each chapter is a test. I recognize now that open book tests really help my brain to grab the new information. I haven't read Parnum's book. Let me look this up.
Parham.
Is it Parham, isn't it?
Parham, yeah. No N.
Yeah, I thought so. I know who that is. I have been told by a number of people that our virology text should have questions at the end of each chapter as well, because it helps people to learn. Questions are very hard to make up.
Yes, they are. I always hand out problem sets when I teach virology, problem sets made up of old exams and that kind of stuff, because yeah. I think actually where questions are most helpful is when you're teaching genetics, because genetics is kind of a puzzle discipline, but it works for virology as well. I also have I run a problem session at the end of the course I teach, and I see lots of lights turning on during that thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, writing exams is my least fun task. It's hard.
It's
really
hard.
Hard to do.
Yeah, I agree.
So coming up with a bunch of questions for, you know, describing stuff that exists is not all that, you know, it's hard enough, but not impossible. But Making up problems out of nowhere is really tough.
Yeah, and you have to make new ones up every year.
Ugh.
I look at it as a challenge, so it's not a burden. Make up good. If you make good questions, they can be fun.
I'm out of questions.
No, you're not out of questions. You always have questions. That's why you do TWIV.
Okay.
Just be curious.
Tell you what, we can write my exam on the next.
Sure, TWIV. That's a good idea. All right, second, here's a question from a person who is really not qualified to ask the question, me. Now, that's not true. You're qualified to ask any question you want.
Absolutely. Of course.
Regarding TWIV 87, a fireside chat with Professor Graham Hatfield. Great episode, by the way. I so enjoyed it. A person named Jason sent a link to scientist infected by a computer virus. Okay, wait a minute. Infected with the virus, and not only infected, but his body became a conduit for replicated viral information so that it could be transferred to his computer? There must be some leap over basic rules of viral infection going on here. So what are the rules? Don't viruses have to bind to human sialic acid receptors? Don't they have to have specific mechanisms for making the cell do their bidding and generating copies of the genetic information? One, does what happened to this scientist constitute infection? Two, does that article seem a little simple to you, and is the Tech World site reliable? Three, last but not least, what would be the mechanism by which binary computer information could replicate, infect, a wet human body? I'm not getting it at all. I don't even understand how it could be released by the chip as a particle or picked up by the computer as a particle or as digital information. How would it be assessed? Okay, let's do that first. Who wants to weigh in?
Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I think this it was an amusing story, but I think I guess I didn't point out at the time, and maybe we should have discussed this a little bit. There's a little bit of hype going on here. This is not a scientist who was actually infected in the biological sense by a computer virus. He implanted a chip. And then infected the implanted chip with a computer virus.
How would he infect the chip?
He had a data transfer system. I guess it's an RFID type or wireless.
Wireless, okay.
So he has a wireless connection. He connects he sends the data to the chip. It's a computer virus, and then the chip can transfer it back to the computer.
Wirelessly again, right?
Right, which is, philosophically, it's no different from somebody standing there holding an iPod and transferring a virus to it.
Right.
It's just that the thing happened to be under his skin at the time, so the claim is that he's the first human infected by a computer virus, but no, he wasn't really infected in the virological sense. His cells were not infected by a computer virus, because that would be impossible.
I guess the point was that computer-based things that are implanted in us are susceptible to computer viruses.
Right. The point that he was making was there's some hype attached to it, but he was making a serious point, which is that medical prosthetics have been, incorporating lots and lots of technology in recent years, and there hasn't been a lot of thought about security for that technology. So if you can wirelessly transfer a computer virus to an embedded device that happens to be implanted under someone's skin, so it's a proof of principle there, why couldn't you transfer a computer virus to somebody's pacemaker?
Sure. I mean, they could be walking down the street and you could infect their
sure,
pacemaker.
You could infect their device. It would not cause a viral infection in the biological sense, right. but it could be deadly nonetheless.
Also, you can imagine if you implant a chip in your child with all the information about them in case they're ever abducted, someone could walk past them and take that information wirelessly, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is way off base, but this reminds me of an old episode of Rocky and Bullwinkle. Are you guys old enough for this?
Yeah, sure. I do.
I vaguely remember the show, but I don't remember this episode.
So it's only marginally related, but it's close enough, where Boris Badenoff, the evil guy, sent a bunch of mechanical mice to the U.S. This is a technical attack. Sent a bunch of mice to the U.S. who ate everybody's television antennas. And the entire population went crazy because they couldn't watch television, right? So we could see a a cyber terror attack where we went and scrambled everybody's televisions with some sort of computer virus, and American society would melt down.
So her last point is very good. Another related question, are we not infected by the phages that infect our gut bacteria? In other words, a virus can be present in our body somewhere, but not infecting our own human cells, because infection is a specific process. True, or what would you say on this? So you really do understand, Jenny.
Yes, she does. Right?
So she wants to know now, so because this is a computer virus, is it infecting us? Because we have phages in our gut bacteria.
Yeah, I don't think of phage as infecting us. I think of them as infecting the bacteria in us.
Yeah, I would think so. Of course, it depends how you define us. if we are us plus our bacteria,
right, then they're infecting us.
Because if you took all the bacteria away, we probably wouldn't exist, right?
Right.
Well, we'd be having a hard time.
Our gut bacteria are an essential part of us.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't think there's an answer. I think it depends on your interpretation, but, they're not infecting human cells, but they are in your gut. So the computer virus, well, the chip you don't really need, right?
Right.
It's an extraneous thing, so I wouldn't call it part of us. So there I would say it's not infecting us, but it's possible that you could describe phages as infecting us.
Fair enough. You have a pacemaker, that's part of you, right?
Yeah, you take it out, you die, right?
Right.
It is, but it's not an inherent part of being human.
This is a really interesting question.
Yeah,
it is.
So, listeners, what do you think? Let us know. Are we infected by bacteriophages? Are we infected by viruses that affect our pacemakers or other essential electronics, embedded electronics? Very interesting. As technology proceeds, the questions change. Love your show and look forward to enjoying your answer on your podcast. Jenny is from Oneonta, New York.
Yeah, no wonder she spends a lot of time loading firewood.
That's near Buffalo, is that right?
It's up there.
Firewood and paint. Well, right now you're probably loading a lot of firewood.
Or she's glad she loaded firewood.
Cold up there. Yes. The next email is from Brent. Hi, guys. Love the podcasts, especially the history behind the discoveries. When I was at primary school, there was an animated movie that showed the immune system fighting the germs. They looked like blobs with steel helmets and guns fighting the nasty germs. It was shown around the second half of the 1970s. Do you have any idea what it was called and if there are any copies available? Cheers and keep up the good work. Hey, you think we're old or something, Brent? You guys know anything about this?
No, I don't. Actually, the movies that I remember from high school were in the 60s. And there were a bunch of them that were made by Bell Labs. One was called Our Mr. Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another one that about circulation. They were terrific movies. They were really good. But I don't know who made this one, and I don't know anything about it.
Maybe some of our listeners know.
Could be.
Yeah, this is around my time in elementary school too, but I don't recall this movie. And I would suggest if you can Google some stuff about it. If that doesn't yield any results, then maybe go to eBay. People trade old films on there, including old 16mm, like educational films. You might be able to find it that way.
I'm surprised it's not on YouTube. A lot of stuff.
It may be. I don't know. Yeah, if we had a title or something, we could search it up. But then Brent probably could have done the same thing himself.
I just want to let everyone know that when I was in school, when they wanted to show us a movie, they used to roll in a projector and film and put 16mm film through it.
Oh, yeah. Too. Yeah.
You remember that, Alan, too?
Oh, yeah absolutely. I was one of the AV geeks who learned.
Yeah, you're a projector nerd. So was I.
Yeah.
You had to know how to clear a jam and all that sort of thing.
People made fun of those guys.
Well, yeah.
Nowadays, they just have a laptop and they dial up a video. It's very different. So, Brent, if any of our listeners know about it, then maybe they'll tell us. Otherwise, search around. Jamie writes, single-stranded positive sense RNA with DNA intermediate. Why is the replication of this virus type so different from single-stranded positive RNA. Where is the DNA intermediate coming from?
Well, whatever works, right? why? That's one of those teleological why questions.
Oh, maybe why it's not. Maybe it's not that. What's the word? Maybe he just wants a basic answer, like reverse transcriptase, right?
Yeah.
Right. The virus brings in an enzyme to reverse transcribe the RNA into a DNA intermediate. Why it does that is known only to the virus.
Why? Right. Oh, that's a why question.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it works. Yeah. As you said, Rich, that's the thing. And we've got 7 genome classes of viruses, and that's because that's all there are. And they work. They all work. Can you think of an 8th genome class? Well, yeah, they're probably like RNA-DNA hybrids, right?
Actually, one that we haven't talked about is ambisense.
Yeah.
Right? Viruses that have, both in a single strand, both polarities, both some genes that are present in the sense orientation and some that are present in the antisense orientation.
Yeah, right.
And I haven't even thought carefully about how those guys, I haven't studied carefully how those guys replicate.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that at all. Maybe we will at some point.
At any rate, the guys with the DNA intermediates, the retroviruses, are what they are. And as Alan said, they bring in a reverse transcriptase, and that's where the DNA comes from because it copies the RNA into DNA. It gets integrated and then gets recopied into RNA. And the guys that are just single-stranded positive sense RNA that replicate through an RNA intermediate use an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, okay? And they do it the same way all the time. Why they do it differently and how that evolved, no one knows.
Although you can speculate that the DNA intermediate may give them higher fidelity. In the replication process, RNA replication is a pretty low fidelity process. So by reverse transcribing the original copy of their genome as it comes into the cell, they get it into DNA, which gets replicated with higher fidelity, and then they get better RNA copies out the other end. But obviously, it's also good enough to do the RNA-directed RNA synthesis because we have viruses that do that.
Plus, making a DNA copy and parking it as a provirus in a genome for the long term is a pretty slick trick.
That could be very handy, yes, depending on your pathogenesis cycle and how you're transmitted.
Okay, and also check out TWIV66, reverse transcription. Charles writes, "Dear TWIV, I have been posed with the question, do viruses ever encode the ability to decode mRNA? And am unsure how to answer it. Could you please provide clarification on the explanation? Thanks." I have a feeling this was for an exam, and it is a very old question.
So he's already taken the exam.
Probably.
So what this makes me think of is it's like asking, do viruses encode ribosomes?
Right. Whole spiel, ribosomes,
right.
tRNAs, synthetases, yeah.
And the answer to that is no. As a matter of fact, we recently discussed one definition of viruses as replicating thingies that do not encode ribosomes,
right.
Specifically.
Yeah, I would say the answer is no. Although we might find one day.
Sure.
Because, a lot of these larger viruses, memes have, they encode tRNAs, they encode tRNA synthetases. So, I don't know, a whole ribosome probably that would, I don't know, but we haven't found it yet. So there you go, Charles. I hope you got the question right. John writes, this is our artist from Australia. I'm not sure I'm happy with this one. Dixon looks a little too evil for my liking. And he sent us a drawing of Dixon, which will be our show badge for this week. You guys have seen this one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's good.
I like it.
I think it looks good. Yeah.
I do. Dixon does not, but too bad.
Yeah.
I think he looks cheery and happy. And you know what? It's a caricature.
Yeah. And I also think that this is appropriate for this week. So it's the week before Christmas.
Yes.
We're going to put this.
Right.
He does look a lot like Santa Claus, I think.
Yeah.
That's a great job, John. It's beautiful. I love the beard, too. Really nice. So then the next one will be you, Rich. Next week, we'll unveil Rich.
Scary.
No, I like yours, too.
Yeah, it's good.
Jeff writes, I'm a postdoc working in a virology lab who recently discovered your show. I really enjoy it and got another grad student in the lab hooked on it too. Great. I've been listening to some of your archived shows and heard a question in TWIV73 about applying drugs targeting reverse transcriptase to the treatment of cancer-causing viruses. You guys mentioned that HBV, hepatitis B virus, has reverse transcriptase activity and could possibly be targeted with the same drugs, but did a quick search to find that AZT or zidovudine doesn't work. It's true that AZT doesn't work, but there are two HIV inhibitors that are effective against HBV and have been approved by the NIH for this purpose. Lamivudine or 3TC, and tenofovir, which made headlines as the first moderately successful topical anti-HIV gel. You also indicated that RT inhibitors are unlikely to be effective against other viruses that don't have RT, but I thought it worth mentioning that nucleoside analogs are often effective against diverse viral polymerases. Adefovir, another approved treatment for HBV, is quite similar to tenofovir and has been shown to have anti-HIV and anti-herpes virus activity. As you probably know, many of the approved treatments for herpes viruses, hepatitis C virus, and other viruses are nucleoside or nucleotide analogs that are not so different from RT inhibitors. Like RT, viral DNA polymerases are more likely to be inhibited by these analogs than cellular polymerases, making these types of compounds so useful as antivirals. Just thought I would add my two cents. Keep up the good work.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Cool.
Very nice, Jeff. Thank you for the clarification. He's absolutely right. And these drugs often cross-inhibit. Great. And the last one is from Chad. Greetings. I just recently started listening to your podcast after hearing about it so much on Futures in Biotech. I was a bit resistant at first. Though I am a grad student in molecular biology, I work with plants, not viruses, so I wasn't sure how much I would really get from it. I have to admit, I enjoy it greatly and have learned quite a bit, so thanks for putting out one of the best science podcasts around. Listening to your latest podcast, number 100, I was very much interested in the discussions regarding science education. Of course, I agree that more is needed, but I was wondering how much is enough. It's already known that many students lack sufficient understanding in even more basic and essential skills like mathematics and reading. As much as a greater scientific literacy is needed amongst the general population, reality is that there is only so much that can be taught in elementary, middle school, and high school. Given the breadth of topics in science that must be covered, physics, chemistry, biology, etc., what is essential and what can we do without? I don't want to come across as skeptical critical of the calls for more or better science education, but when these calls are made, rarely do I see anyone answer the necessary question of what is critical for students to learn. That's really a good point, right?
Yep,
it is.
I know that down at the Morningside campus of Columbia, they have a science program for non-science majors. And they're not even sure what to teach people, right? Do you give them physics? Do you give them chemistry, biology? How much do you give them? What exactly? I think you just give them virology and that's it.
I think you should choose from various topics the ones that are most likely to teach people the central principles of science. You know, you can choose some physics topics that illustrate, and the chemistry topics and biology topics that illustrate how science works, and don't get hung up so much on the individual details of it, because people can find those later by themselves if they understand that this is an iterative process of coming up with hypotheses, attempting to falsify them, and then having others replicate the results, coming up with new hypotheses and attempting to falsify those, and gradually advancing knowledge that way. So I think it almost doesn't matter what the subjects are that you choose from. I think what matters is that people understand how science operates and how they can approach any of these topics that they come across as they come up. What's missing.
Yeah. I also want people to have a clear understanding of what they are. I want them to have enough understanding of biology, and I suppose this means at least a little bit of chemistry, to understand, you know, that they're made of cells, and it's just a bunch of chemical reactions and a bunch of electrochemistry and all that kind of stuff that came together, from what I can tell, by accident, to make all of this stuff growing around us. And very importantly, that humans are no better or worse than any other organism out there. Okay, no better or worse than the trees, no better or worse than the bacteria or anything else. I think too many people don't have an appreciation for this. It's hard for me to imagine what it's like to live without that appreciation, but I think most people do. And I think it would change things a little bit if people understood this.
And to understand that that is not a cynical
right.
viewpoint, that to borrow someone else's phrase, that there is a grandeur in this view of life.
Right.
I think this is difficult because he's talking about elementary, middle school, high school, and college, really. So totally different ways of teaching. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. You know, I teach undergraduates and graduate students, and I teach them virology. So I don't really know what they need to know to understand that. I mean, they have to have basic biology. They need advanced biology. They need biochemistry. They need organic. But everybody doesn't have to know all that stuff.
Right.
These are students who want to learn virology.
Right.
But, no, you know, I have my kids always complaining why they have to learn all this stuff. So, you know, they teach them that when you put salt, so table salt in water, it dissolves and, you know, the buoyancy changes. And they want to know why they have to know this. So maybe the key is to explain why these things are important more, not just to present them. I think you touched on that, Alan.
Yeah, I think context is missing from a lot of science education, because in this country it's been structured to be easy to test.
Right.
So
right.
we cram people with lots of facts because it's easy to set up a multiple choice exam to test whether they've remembered all those facts. But that's not science, and that's not a useful way of thinking about the world. It's not just a mass of random facts.
Yes.
There's an organization to it. And you need to understand how that organization came to be and kind of the outlines of what it is. I think people should have an understanding of Newtonian mechanics, even if they can't regurgitate the equations for a complex pulley system. They can at least understand, oh, there's a mathematical formula for this, and that it breaks down at the atomic level, and that's what we know from quantum mechanics and so on. But you wouldn't necessarily have to have all the details, and unfortunately, that's kind of hard to fit into our current system of education, because we need stuff that's easy to test for.
So I think here's an appreciation for my high school chemistry teacher that I think touches on what you're talking about, Alan. We had this new curriculum called, I think it was called Chem Study. This was in my chemistry class, and it had a textbook and it had a laboratory workbook. And the first assignment in the laboratory workbook was to observe a candle. Right, so we're sitting here in class. Each of us has a candle. We light the candle, and we're supposed to make notes on this. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is going to be a long semester. This is really dumb. And I take my notes dutifully and that kind of stuff. And then we're supposed to report back. And we did this a student at a time reporting their observations. And I report mine. I say, there's a flame, and it's orange, and it's got a sort of a blue bit there. And the tip of the wick is sort of glowing where it hits the edge of the flame. And on the top of the candle below the wick, there's a puddle of wax. And the teacher, McNabb, stopped me and he said, how do you know that's wax? I've never forgotten that. I don't think
That's
I realized good. It until years later. And I don't know if – I don't think that was necessarily in the workbook. I think that was Keith.
Yeah,
so sure. He understood what was going on. How do you know that's wax? It's one of the most important lessons I ever learned.
That's excellent.
I think there are many, many people who think about this to greater extents than we do. But it's a great question, and if our listeners have any ideas – send them in.
I wonder what Chad does for a living. You probably ought to be a teacher.
Well, we have some teachers who listen. Tell us what you think. Sure. What science do kids have to know? My feeling is that we don't need as many facts as principles, but you do need some facts.
Yeah, right? Sure. In order to understand the principles, exactly. You need some facts, certainly.
And I think you have to. Maybe the most important thing is to emphasize to students why you're teaching them this. Always, over and over. Yep. Why are we teaching you this? Otherwise, they think, why do I have to learn this? Right? I think that's really important. And I don't think they do it. They just come in the morning and go, okay, open to page 47, and blah, you know. Tell them why you're doing it.
I never had any motivation to learn math until my dad taught me how to navigate on a boat.
There you go. There you
and,
go.
You know, how do you take these bearings and turn them into a position on a chart? And it's trigonometry.
Yep.
And it just clicked. I said, oh, my God, this is there's a use for this stuff in the real world.
Well, that's the click moment is very important. My high school son is learning parallel equations right now. You guys remember that? So, you know, a plumber charges, you know, $80 for 2 hours and $150 for 4 hours. You know, how many hours does it take to get to this point? You have to make two equations and solve them. And he's telling me, Dad, why do I have to learn this stuff? And I said, believe me, when you go buy a car and you want to know, should you put $2,000 down and pay $50 a month or $50 down and $300 a month, this will help you.
Right. You're buying a house and, should we buy any points on the mortgage? Exactly. But, yes.
But you cannot just tell people that. You have to bring in real life examples because telling isn't enough. Anyway, that's enough because we could go on forever, right? This is great stuff, but we have to wrap it up here with some picks of the week. And let us start with Rich.
Okay, so a student, a graduate student, sent me this following a discussion I had with her. It's actually an article in The Scientist. That's the top 10 innovations of 2010. So, like I said, it's an article in The Scientist where they have a few scientists evaluate what they think are the top 10 new innovations from this year. And I'm not going to go through all of them. There are a lot of really interesting ones. But mostly what I want to draw attention to is this first one, which is third-generation sequencing. This is a sequencing technology that is being developed by Pacific Biosciences called SMRT Sequencing. That stands for Single Molecule Real-Time Sequencing. And there's a nice video that comes on this, a terrific video on the site that describes this technology and in detail, and it's really well done. So this is kind of sort of like Sanger sequencing in that it is dependent on tracking a DNA polymerase making DNA off of a template molecule, okay? And it uses fluorescent nucleotides, but the similarity kind of ends there. There's two basic innovations to this. First of all, the fluorescently labeled nucleotides are labeled on the phosphates so that when a nucleotide is incorporated, the fluorescent label, having been in the polymerase for some period of time during the incorporation, then leaves. And the important thing about that is that you don't have to do any chemistry to the DNA molecule. It's ready to receive the next nucleotide. So there's very little chemistry that goes on here in contrast to some other of these high throughput sequencing techniques. The second part of the technology is amazing. It's really nanotechnology. The polymerase is fixed to the bottom of a chamber that's 70 nanometers wide and has a capacity of 20 septiliters. That's a septiliter is 10 to the minus 21 liters.
My gosh.
So 70 nanometers wide, that's the size of a virus.
Yeah.
Okay? And you got a single polymerase molecule attached to a template DNA, and the polymerase molecule is fixed to the bottom of this cell, and it's got a glass bottom, so there's a bunch of optics and lasers and stuff that can look through the bottom of this. And you flood the cell with these fluorescent nucleotides, and from the video, it looks like they're all there all the time, and they're swimming around, so there's probably a background of fluorescence. But as each one is incorporated, it has to spend time in the polymerase. And during that time, I don't know if the polymerase actually makes it fluoresce or the fact that it's stalled and fixed for that period of time makes that fluorescence detectable. But at any rate,
it's held in the polymerase for a certain period of time, and the polymerase is right there in the laser beam. So you get a spike in that fluorescence.
Right. So you just, with respect to time, you just read what fluorescent guys are trapped in the polymerase for this period of time as the polymerase is polymerizing. And you just trace this as the different colors with respect to time. And it looks like a chromatogram off of a regular sequencing read. And that's it. And you have apparently some sort of a platform with thousands of these going on at the same time. The video is terrific because you see all the colors flashing in these little dots. It looks like a starry sky or something, a colorful starry sky. Their hype is that this technology will allow them ultimately to sequence a genome in minutes for less than $100.
Amazing.
This is amazing. The instrument costs $695,000.
Consumables and sequencing kits sold separately.
I was talking to Dave Bloom about this today. I showed him the video and I was talking about this. And he says, you know, before too long, you're going to have a machine like this on every benchtop.
Yeah, maybe maybe not.
Like your PCR machine. And you drop a piece of DNA in it that gets sequenced for you. At any rate, it's very cool. It's a great video and a fascinating technology.
Absolutely.
So what I want to do is use this. I want to give them a tube of poliovirus and sequence every RNA in there so I can see what the population looks like.
Absolutely.
Because you can't do that now for viruses. Right. There's too much error.
Right.
But that'll be possible. So you can see what the quasi-species is. Right. Very cool. That's great. Alan, what have you for us?
My pick this week is a site called AvoSET, the Avian Vocalization Center. And this is at Michigan State University. And what they've done is they've compiled a whole bunch of recordings, thousands and thousands of recordings of bird songs. And you can search by common name or scientific name, and it'll give you recordings of those birds. So you can see you see a bird, you can hear what it sounds like, or if you hear a bird, you could search the database with what you think it might have been, and it'll give you the sounds that you can choose from and figure out what it was. And I think it's a really cool project, because frequently you can't see the birds, you just hear them, and you wonder, gee, I wonder what that was. And it's continuously building this thing.
They give you the sonograms of these things.
Yes, they also give you, so you get a recording and you get a sonogram of it, so you see the spikes in the bird's song as well.
All right,
and a nice little Google map of where the recording came from.
Exactly.
All right, here you go. Here's one of them. All right, what is that?
It's a bird.
Great. Excellent. You win.
Good, huh? Good.
It's the white-naped brush finch. I wanted to search finch because, you know, they have hepatitis B in their genomes.
Right.
But I got this guy. And then they have a map, yeah, like you say. Very cool. That's great. Let's do the same for viruses.
The sounds of viruses?
Yeah. Well, okay. If you're small enough, I guess they do.
Okay. What virus is that?
were you coughing or throwing up?
Well, see, that's the problem. The recording quality wasn't very good, was it?
What's this virus?
That's a rhinovirus.
Yeah, that's a rhino. Okay, that's great. Avian Vocalization Center. My pick was sent by Nadia, or as I call my daughter, Nadia. Who's at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And she says, hello, Vincent, Dick, and guests of TWIV. I just wanted to start off by saying that I love the show. As a recent graduate in clinical laboratory sciences, your show is great as it has served as a relaxing brain massage after a hard day of studying. I would like to suggest a pick of the week for your show. My microbiology professor sent me this link that I am now forwarding to you for a store on Etsy.com that sells soaps that look like bacteria growing on petri dishes. My favorite is the glow-in-the-dark Legionella. Keep up the fantastic work, guys. Enjoy. It's a company called Cleaner Science, and it's soap in the form of petri dishes. Candida, Klebsiella, fluorescent bacteria, streaked out or growing in colonies. Really, really cool.
Very cool.
These are awesome. Is it antibacterial soap?
It is, actually, I think. There's some information here. Let's see. It says, soap consists of an all-natural hypoallergenic coconut oil base. This base, when undyed, has a slight amber color.
Okay, so good. Good. It's not antibacterial.
It's good for your skin.
I like the ones that fluoresce.
Very
cool.
Those
are cool.
I would not want to use it. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because probably just a couple of uses and you wreck it.
Yeah, right.
But I have some germaphobe friends I'd like to send these to.
Comes in a petri dish, which is cool.
Yeah.
And comes with a card with information about the fungus or bacteria that it's modeled after.
It's wonderful.
Nice. Hey, thanks, Nadia. That's great. I love this stuff. This is going along with those fuzzy virus plush toys, right? Remember those?
Right, yeah. Yes.
So thanks, Nadia. And anybody else have cool picks, send them in. And that will do it for another TWIV. You can find us on Facebook, This Week in Virology, all one page. We have a fan page there, and you can go and learn more about us, see pictures and that sort of thing. And, of course, for listening, you can find us at iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or also on Miro. I put us lately, although it doesn't seem to be working. If you go to TWIV on iTunes, leave a comment. It helps keep us on the front page of the Medicine Podcast Directory, and you can also subscribe for free to keep up with each episode. You can also listen on your smartphone, either the iPhone, iPad universe or the Android universe. There are apps for both with the Microbe World app. Check it out at microbeworld.org. And of course, if you go to our website, twiv.tv, we have a place where you can play the podcast. You can download it. You have show notes, transcripts, letters. Wonderful place. If you like TWIV, tell others about it. Links and reviews in iTunes are particularly helpful. Send your questions and comments to twiv@twiv.tv. Alan Dove is at alandove.com. Great to have you again.
Always a pleasure.
And Rich Condit is at the University of Florida. Thanks, Rich.
Great to be here.
I made That's a shortened fun. Version of your webpage. It's yep. bit.ly/poxdoc.
Great.
We had to bring you into the shortened world. alandove.com/bit.ly/poxdoc. I'm Vincent Racaniello at virology.ws. You've been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.